You're listening to the Buckeye Visualist Podcast Show.
It's the Buckeye Visualist Podcast, an audio space for members of the Ohio News Photographers Association. This show focuses on all things photojournalism in the Buckeye State and beyond. I'm your host, Lori King, and if you're a fan of this podcast, then you might have noticed I've taken a bit of a hiatus, but I'm back, and I couldn't be more excited to host my next two guests, Signal Akron's first editor-in-chief, Zoo Zake, and multimedia reporter and producer, Cassie Filkins, both Kent State graduates. Welcome to the show, ladies.
Thanks, Lori. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
It would have been so cool to sit across from you in the downtown Akron office, but inclement weather, it's snowy out there, put a damper on those plans. But this story is still a great way to kick off a new year of Buckeye Visualist podcasts. Our topic for this episode is Signal Akron, one of the nation's largest local nonprofit newsroom startups. We're going to talk about their hyper laser focus on Akron by Akronites. Sue is leading that small but mighty newsroom, which launched just last month. Before taking the helm, she was a journalism professor, student media advisor, and founder of the Kent State News Lab at Kent State University, where she taught the next generation of journalists. And before that, she was the managing editor for multimedia and special projects at the Akron Beacon Journal. Sue, the residents of Akron are so lucky to have a visual journalist and photo editor at the helm because, as we all know, visuals are such a vital part of any news publication, whether it's print or online. You absolutely understand the value and power of visuals and multimedia in a news publication, and we'll get into that in a moment. By Sue's side is her former student and current employee, Cassie Filkins. Cassie worked at the Southeast Missourian and the Hartford Current before getting her degree at Kent State and joining the staff of Signal Akron. So, my first question to you both is this. Are you Buckeyes born and raised?
I am. I'm from the Dayton area, grew up out in the Farm Belt, actually was born in the Lima area. And my folks moved around quite a bit, but my mom was from Ohio. And we came back here to live closer to relatives. And my dad worked for NCR his whole career. So NCR was headquartered in Dayton. And so we ended up there.
Yeah. And I am also born and raised in Columbus area. So I grew up in Pickerington. We moved around a bit when I was younger. I spent some time out in Colorado and North Dakota, but then we always came back to Ohio. And then, yeah, I studied at Kent State and then went away for a few years and then came back. So
we are all three Golden Flashes because I graduated from there as well. In fact, I got my bachelor's and my master's there.
I'm also a Bobcat. My undergrad, Terry Eiler would kill me if I didn't say something about being an OU Bobcat from the VizCom school.
Yeah, I was just talking to Sue Morrow. You know, I work with her for the NPPA magazine, and she's a Bobcat.
Yeah, Sue's terrific.
Sue, you started out your photojournalism career at the Akron Beacon Journal in 1986, and over the years worked a variety of positions there, picture editor, assignment editor, director of photography, assistant managing editor for photographic and presentation, which you said was one of your favorite things ever, and then managing editor for multimedia and special projects. You then left the Beacon in 2007 to go to grad school at Kent State and never left. You ended up being a professor there. You have vast multimedia and graphic design experience, but historically speaking, those attributes aren't typically the right resume for leading an entire newsroom. How were you able to overcome that stigma that photographers can't lead newsrooms? And why do you think there is such a stigma?
So I was really fortunate when I was at the Beacon to be in a leadership development program. And my bosses at the time, Jan Leach and then Deborah Adams Simmons, recognized that I had other skill sets. And so they put me in a program that basically pushed me into different areas of the newsroom that I would not have traditionally been working in. I became a metro editor for a period of time so that I would learn how to work with reporters, manage stories, I have to tell you, that was probably the hardest and scariest thing I've ever done in my career. And it was also something I didn't think I would like. But the more I did it, the more I liked it. And the more I think I was able to kind of look at the whole story, not, kind of just the visuals or just the words. And I had already worked a lot in the presentation side of how to package content. How do you build the headlines? How do you build the visuals that go with it? And that included infographics and any, illustrations, photos, the whole design package. So I think a lot of it was that I was just really lucky to be in the right place with the right supervisors who recognized that, someone who maybe has a passion for visuals, which I still do, was also able to do lots of other things and do them really well. It's not any different from having a really good writer and reporter who also takes good pictures. We have a reporter, Doug Brown, on our staff who loves shooting photos, and he's pretty darn good at it. But he's also a terrific reporter. So I think some of it is just being open to the idea that people can do more than one thing well, and it may not be the thing they do the best, but that they can still do it, really well. So I'm just weird that way, I guess.
Yeah, I think a part of the problem is that editors want to put photographers in a box. It's almost like a prescription put out by a doctor where you fill the prescription and then you move on and you fill another prescription and you move on without giving us any chance to spread our wings and do other things. Like when I was at the Blade, I wanted to do podcasts. And it's like, hey, I want to do a podcast on the reporters and how they're doing their stories. Where do they come up with the story idea? How do they break it down? And they said no. You, on the other hand, had bosses who saw the potential to do more and allowed you to do that.
I think a lot of it now, in our newsroom, when we're done hiring, we'll have 9 people, which means at any given time, somebody could be on vacation, somebody could be out on assignment. We all have to cover for each other, and have multiple skill sets. We manage newsletters, we manage social media. Today Cassie has to fill in for somebody on social media. We have documenters, though there will be weeks I fill in on documenters because Kevin, who manages that, will be out. And so I think it's short-sighted in the very tightly staffed newsrooms, especially today, that you can't just have people doing one job. I think they have to, I don't want to say they have to do everything, but I think, and as a manager, I'm going to try and keep them in the areas where they're good, where they're comfortable, where they like the work that they're doing. But, I have to rewrite press releases every so often. That's not my favorite thing, but it's necessary. So I just did one yesterday. I think the more we let people play to their strengths so that they're happy, but also fill the needs of the enterprise, I think that's just the way we have to go today. And I think that's always how it's been. You have to meet the needs of the enterprise, but how do you fulfill, kind of the desires of the employee so that they're happy and content and want to do the work and want to come to work every day?
Gotta say, while perusing your website, it is very image heavy, and I love that. Your website looks visually solid. I'm assuming your 3 to 4 newsletters a week and your social media posts are highly visual as well. Because your newsroom only has one photographer, Cassie, does that mean your reporters are documenting their own images? And is that an expectation when you hire them? And do you provide training once they are hired?
Well, we're about 5 weeks out of the gate, so training hasn't really happened yet. So, I mean, I think every newsroom is going to have reporters take some pictures just because, Cassie's our multimedia person. I've gone out and shot some photos. We've got a couple freelancers that, and we're actually still building that. We're going to try and have a couple of solid freelancers that we can assign things to when Cassie's off or I can't go out. Kevin Dilley is also a recovering photojournalist, so he has really good photo skills. Doug shot an assignment for us last Friday. So yeah, I think it's what needs to get done, and we'll do it the best we can. We haven't even gotten to the point where you know, we've talked about, oh, you know, I can see us doing that. I mean, we talk about how do we do things better. We're still working out our workflows. I mean, we're just a baby out of the gate here. But I think as we see things that we're not real happy with, we'll figure out ways to fix them, train people. If it's just not somebody's skill set, we'll avoid that and figure out a better way to solve that issue. I'm not going to put people who are talented in one way in a very uncomfortable position just because they don't have skills in another area. I mean, there's things I can't do. That's my job as a manager to make sure people can do their best work and not be put in a position of failing. That wouldn't be fair.
You said when you can't go out, are you telling me you're still shooting?
I shoot more now than I have for the last 20 years.
Oh, I'm really surprised about that.
Yeah, no, I was out over Martin Luther King weekend and I had a blast. I think the rust is coming off a little.
This question is for both of you. What do you think about smartphone photojournalism?
I think it's part of the evolution of visual journalism, right? Ironically, Sue was one of my professors who always told me your camera is only as good as the one you have on you. There's times where I'll be out off assignment in the past even, and something happens and I don't have my cameras with me, but I'll have a cell phone, right? I also think utilizing your cell phone to live tweet out things, or, you know, TikTok's so big now. Some of that more social content that is being more regularly consumed is being created on cell phones, right? So I think there's a place for it. I obviously still highly value, you know, using my professional quote unquote gear, but just because you have a nice oven doesn't make you a great cook. So I feel like that's the same, you know, kind of analogy with regardless of gear. So
I actually, a lot of times on an assignment, even though I have my real gear with me, I'll use the cell phone because it gets me in tight spaces better. And I can like hold it across a space to get a different look, like to square something up or get somebody's full face rather than part of their face. So I use it as a tool. I mean, to me, it's just another tool in the toolkit. I've also found in, like, I was in East Palestine a lot in the spring and into the about the middle of the summer before I started this job, and taking students with me. And these were folks who had just had the media, you know, writ large, just parachute into their town in the middle of a, you know, a horrible tragedy. So they were very media shy and reserved about who they would talk to. And I just kind of found that having a cell phone out instead of having, you know, my big camera with the big lens was a much better tool to use in that situation, because they felt less like I was, you know, just kind of appropriating their image or, you know, taking advantage of their misfortune. And I got some really nice portraits with that. So I just think of it as, what's the best tool for the situation I'm in, and how do I get, you know, what I need to get as the storyteller and make somebody feel comfortable in that situation.
Yeah, to kind of add to that, I was also going to say that, you know, when I worked for The Current and would go into neighborhoods where, you know, they weren't used to the news coming in, or they were used to only seeing, you know, news outlets when something bad happened. A lot of times having that big camera can be really intimidating, and it can feel very exploitative and stuff like that. If, you know, I think relationship building is huge. And so a lot of times too, going into communities, sometimes I won't even take my big gear with me, or I'll put a smaller lens on it just so I can put it under my coat, because I want people to trust also. And I want them to know that, like, we're not here to just, you know, like Sue said, appropriate their image. And so I think utilizing cell phones in that way is a way to help make that bridge. So yeah, the tool and the variety of usage, I think, is important to the conversation of how we document our communities.
I was going to let our listeners know, if they don't know, that East Palestine is where that train accident happened that leaked toxic chemicals into the community. So that had to have been one hell of a scene to cover.
I mean, I was there within the first, at the end of the first week, when nobody knew yet. Everything was still smoldering. It was just, it's just, you know, that's a story that goes on for years and potentially generations. So, but the people in East Palestine could not be nicer people, but they're just traumatized at this point. So I felt like I didn't need to add to that. And Cassie's right, the relationship part of it. We were there often enough, and I feel like it's a great example of where if there was a news outlet in East Palestine, there's a story every single day that still could be told from that community. There are three local papers, and one's in Salem, one's in Lisbon, and I forget where the other one is. They've actually done a pretty good job of covering it, but that's not their home community. So to me, it was important to get in there as much as we could to build those relationships. And at some point, people would see us drive by and they'd wave at us because they recognized me with the students from Kent State. So they couldn't have been nicer about it, but you know, we still felt like we had to just be incredibly considerate of how we took their picture.
Let's talk about your competition with the Beacon Journal, the sole daily morning newspaper of record for Akron, which is owned by Gannett. I'm going to assume you don't think there is much of a competition. Can you explain the difference between the Beacon Journal and your online newsroom? What sets Signal Akron apart from that very established paper founded way back in 1839? I mean, you only have 1 month under your belt.
So I don't think of it as a competition. And in fact, we've had a couple conversations about where can we collaborate, because at the end of the day, the goal is to get as much well-reported, accurate news and information out to people in Akron as we possibly can. And so to duplicate, you know, the city council stories and the school board stories and the things that, you know, we naturally are set up to cover doesn't make a lot of sense to me. And I don't think it makes sense to anybody in the news community here. And the Beacon has a really good collaborative past. And so it's just so early right now. They're going through some transitions. Their editor just left to go to the Dispatch. They've had a couple of veteran reporters leave. So they're kind of in a newsroom transition, I would say, right now. But we are looking for ways to do that, because I think every journalist wants their community to be as well informed as they can. You know, for newsrooms, it's competitive in the sense of a football game. You know, you want to be a good sport about it, but you want to, you know, I'm competitive. I'm a former athlete. I'm absolutely competitive about everything. But at the same time, I know the bigger goal isn't to beat the Beacon Journal. It's to make sure that the storytelling is out there. We've had a very beginner conversation about, you know, can we collaborate on school coverage? Because to me, that's one of the most important things happening in Akron right now, is, you know, what's happening with the public schools. And one thing I think that might let us do is not focus so much on the problems that the school has, but look at some of the good things they do as well, which I know is one of the complaints in the community, that, you know, there's only negative attention, and that, you know, the good stuff they're doing doesn't get enough attention anymore. I think the other difference is that right now, if you get our newsletter, you're having a 2 or 3 day a week conversation with me. It's almost like a letter to readers every time. And I think part of what we're trying to build is an accessibility to our newsroom and an ownership of our newsroom by people who live in Akron. So I want to have that conversation with them. What's important to you? What should we be covering? We have documenters, and these are just regular people that we recruit, train, and pay to go to public meetings. That's Kevin Dilley's piece of our newsroom. And that's been a really amazing network for us already, to help us find people in neighborhoods. Cassie's used it a couple times to find people in, to do neighborhood profiles. I think our goal is to be a little bit more rooted at the neighborhood level, so we really know what's affecting people who live in the houses in that neighborhood or live in the apartments in that neighborhood. You know, housing is kind of a subbeat for us because we think it's a big issue for folks. So I think we're trying to be geared more from the grassroots up at the neighborhood level than covering from the institution down, if that makes sense.
We were talking in our last conversation about the power of visuals, especially online. And did you have a space ratio that you try to stick to, that you have a value you feel pretty strongly about? Can you explain that ratio and why it's so important to you?
So it's kind of one of those things that when we would do a project at the Beacon in the old print days, especially the, you know, the bigger investigative projects, we always tried to have a certain amount of space that we allocated for visuals, because we knew that if we didn't do that, besides the storytelling value of the visuals, we knew that if we didn't break up the words, you know, we'd have a very gray page, and it didn't matter how well done the reporting was, people would just not read it. They would open that up and go, oh my gosh, I'm not going to look at this. And so that's been my philosophy pretty much all along, because I don't think looking at a gray web page is a whole lot different than looking at a gray print page. And I think if we have a very important story, we need to figure out how to best visually support that. I don't think you can just write off important stories and say, oh, that's not a visual story. We're not going to figure out what, you know, we can do to help support that. Cassie's terrific about that. She'll go to a school board meeting and shoot 50 photos and gives us an incredible file of people who are important to those stories. So even if it's not, you know, what we want to, you know, like a great standalone image, it's an informative picture of here's this person, here's what they look like. And, you know, in the role, like say they're in the school board room or something like that. So we're trying to, even if they're not, you know, kind of the things I would put in my portfolio, they're still informational images that help support the storytelling. And so for me, it's just incredibly important to have as many people as we're talking about in stories, as many sources as we have in stories to show people what they look like. I like to hear them too. I mean, that's the great thing about the web, is it gives you the ability to tell multidimensional stories. You know, sometimes that's one more thing we don't have time to take care of or do. But in my ideal world, we would be able to see and hear everybody that's in a story online because we have the ability to do that. We just don't have time to do that.
I think we both agree to that. If any publication is not visually supported, nobody's going to read the entire thing. That's not being cynical, that's being real. Can you explain on that train of thought of without the visuals, and I think you expanded on it just a little bit ago, without the visuals, you're going to have less people wanting to read it or finish reading it. They'll look at the photos and be inspired maybe to read more of the story.
I track research. I mean, that's proven over and over again in print and in digital, that if you have a visual, people will look at it. They'll read the cut line. They read the headlines. That unfortunately, that the actual story is the last thing people will read or spend time on. And if you think about the generation that's been raised on phones, you know, we're in the swipe generation now. It's like, wow, you know, TikTok, boom, 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 how many a day? So I think if we're not visual and we're not telling stories in those ways, we don't have a chance. One of the major hospital systems here is potentially going to be sold. And we just put a Q&A out last night that I read. Of course, I read everything from start to finish because I'm the editor. It's a really good, easy to read explainer of what's going on with that. So I think if anybody who is concerned about what happens with that hospital, or if they use that hospital for their healthcare, would read that, they would feel better and have a much better idea of what's going on. You know, and this is a business story, right? It's about venture capital and, you know, what's happening in healthcare and things like that. And I found it incredibly intimidating to send a reporter out to try and cover that because I'm not a business reporter, right? I'm not a business editor, but this was a terrific explainer. But we don't have great visual support for it. And that's nobody's fault. It's just timing and, you know, it's a paper story. But I kept thinking, wow, I really hope people read this. I really hope people read this because it's really good. But I know without the visuals bouncing them through it, that's not going to be as likely.
I just hope editors who are not photographers get a chance to listen to this. So I'm hoping that listeners, please share with your editors this podcast because they really need to hear it.
The other conversation I have is about, you know, kind of that editorial independence. We all end up using handout photos, but when and where and how? And you know, we all have newsroom policies where, well, no, we don't let sources read the story before it gets published. You know, we'll read parts back or we'll verify facts, things like that. But if you're letting the people that you're covering, and I don't want to characterize them because they're all good people and they don't want to mislead us, but if you're only looking at handout photos all the time, then how much editorial independence are you maintaining if you don't create your own visuals, which are, to me, just like a quote in a story? You know, the way we go about taking photos, it's we are telling a story with that photo and it's our interpretation of it. We're the witness. But if we're not witnessing it visually, how do we really know, you know, what's really the story to tell? So I think if you're not taking good care of your visual reporting, you're really farming out a chunk of your editorial independence, whether you realize it or not.
I also just kind of want to add to, you know, the value of visuals being, you know, looking at it from the grassroots local coverage, right? I don't think we can tell those stories of our community without showing who our community is. And so I think that's also critical to especially our newsroom and the work that we're doing. Something that I love about Akron is like you go out and you see everybody who knows everybody, right? And people like to see their picture also. I mean, you know, stories aside, you know, they think it's so cool that they have their photo taken by the local paper or, you know, it's going to be online and they can show, you know, their family, their friends, which is great for us because then that's more eyes on our coverage and hopefully more folks who read our work. Every story has a human element. You know, the business one's a little more complicated, like Sue kind of said, but I mean, it affects people. So who are those people? Let's show, humanize the story. And I think visuals are an important part of creating that humanization of what we do.
When Black Press Media out of Vancouver bought the Beacon Journal back in 2006, you said they immediately cut 40 people out of the newsroom, which landed disproportionately on the photo and art departments, and that they didn't understand why visuals were so important. This is disturbing. You said the new owner walked into the art department and wondered why they were drawing these pretty pictures. He didn't understand that those pretty graphics and the photo department images were actually one of the most accessible ways for people to get into the paper. Soon after that, the art department ceased to exist. And after that, the photo department started to shrink. What used to be about, I don't know, 12, 15 has been slashed to, you said three now?
Yeah, the Beacon Journal photo department is three people now. That's taken years to happen, but yeah, no, it's three people.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's a trend that's not slowing down. But isn't that the way these days?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, what we saw at the kind of the end of the Knight Ritter days of the Beacon Journal was drastic. I mean, those were disproportionate even compared to other kind of slower cuts that were happening in the industry. But I think it shows a lack of understanding at that time of the power of visuals. I mean, the illustrations that the Beacon Journal artists created for the Beacon Journal were some of the things we heard the most about from people in the community. You know, it was just an amazingly talented staff. And the photo staff per person was also one of the most talented, I would argue, in the country, certainly in the region. And people knew our names. I mean, I was on that photo staff when I first came to Akron. People, we'd go out in the community and people would go, oh, do you work with that guy, Ed Suba? He takes great sports pictures. I mean, it was just great. People read your name under your photo. And, you know, and that was one of the very cool things I think about the Beacon was that the community felt like they owned it. That's what I want to have for Signal. I want the people in Akron to feel like they have such good accessibility to us that they feel like they can change how we do things if they feel strongly about it. And of course, we have to agree with them too. But I want that level of, hey, I can have a conversation with the editor. I can see Cassie out in the community and say, hey, I just wanted to tell you, I was a little bit upset about this, or I really liked what you guys did with this. And so I think that's incredibly important. And I don't know that newsrooms are very good at it universally. You know, we're so used to, especially old people like me in this industry, we're so used to just pushing it out there because it's what we've decided is good for people, not necessarily what people have decided they need to know. And so, you know, we're trying to be a little bit more, I think, open to the idea that, you know, people know in the community that they need to know more about something. And that's what, you know, we want to be there for.
Let's give a shout out to those three photographers at the Akron Beacon Journal. Who are they?
So Phil Masturzo, my old buddy, terrific sports and feature photographer. Like I can pick the paper up or look online and I know it's Phil's photo. Jeff Lang, who's the newest addition, also incredibly talented, really good news photographer, good sports photographer. And Mike Cardew, who's also been there. I hate to think how long because I was there before him. You know, terrific kind of general assignment guy, gets out in the community, talks to people, very well informed, pretty good group of folks.
Sue, as a former professor at Kent State, what do you think is the state of photojournalism education in our modern era? Are we in trouble or are we just in a state of transition? How do we prepare the next generation of visual journalists? I know I'm doing my part by teaching multimedia and photojournalism courses at Wayne State University in Detroit and the University of Toledo. Thank goodness these two schools are committed to visual journalism classes, but there are a lot of journalism schools that aren't.
So I think all journalism schools should be teaching visual journalism. That doesn't mean necessarily photojournalism, but I think all journalists have to have visual skills at this point. And that includes design thinking, you know, what's a color palette? You know, how do I edit photos? How do I create a package of content online? You know, it used to be that you had a copy editing class, and those are important skills as well. But to me, knowing how to think about content holistically and how to put it together, I don't know too many journalists who aren't going to have to put that together online and understand how to work on a website, how to build a social media story, how to work in Canva so that you can build an Instagram story. It's a bucket of skills really at this point, but all of it is tied together by having a good visual sense, compositional sense, some of the really basic things you get from being a photojournalist. And I can't speak for all schools. I don't know that that's necessarily a strength in the university communities. I know some universities are really good at it, but I think obviously I'm a visual journalist, but I think if I look at all the people that I've hired, everyone on our staff is visually inclined. You know, every single person has a good understanding of composition, you know, what makes a strong photo. They have what I would just call good content sense. And I actually think if somebody has good visual sense, it makes them a better reporter because they can describe better, makes them a better narrative writer because that's, you know, sits largely on descriptive writing. So for me, it's an incredible value. I also think it's an accessibility issue. The more visual our websites, the more visual our content, the easier it is for people to understand. And that's a huge goal for Signal Akron, is to be an accessible newsroom for all of our audience, not just parts of our audience.
Yeah, my students at Wayne State are journalism majors and not photojournalists. We don't have a photojournalism program. So I'm teaching mobile visual journalism with your smartphones, because maybe one or two have cameras. For the most part, they're going to be out there with their smartphones. So that's what I'm teaching them, how to use that properly and to start using it and be more comfortable with using it. Cassie, you are of that younger generation. So I'll ask you the same question I asked Sue. What do you think is the state of photojournalism education today, and what was your education like?
I think I got really lucky with my education. I'm involved in Kent State Student Media right now as well, and have kind of seen the shift from when I graduated to kind of the programming there now. But, you know, I think my education was really great. I'll share that I was a transfer student to Kent. I started at Columbus State Community College, and I didn't really like photojournalism. I liked pretty pictures, right? So I liked taking those macro photos of like nature and, you know, those pretty wall art stuff, right? Which I still love. But I transferred to Kent then to get a 4-year photo degree. And I remember my first semester, I took Photojournalism 1 with Dave LaBelle and Visual Storytelling with Gary Harwood. Amazing professors, love them both to death. I almost dropped the program because I could not understand what made a good picture. And I remember Dave LaBelle showing us a photo of this guy at, I think it was like a Santa run or something, but he was in like a Speedo and he was stretching between two cars. And I was like, that's not a good photo. What is he talking? You know, in hindsight, I get that, like, okay, yeah, that's a great photo. I was fortunate to have wonderful professors, you know, also including Sue and Bruce Zake as well, and who really kind of helped me understand photojournalism and visual storytelling. And as cliche as it is, I say that like photojournalism chose me because I just wanted to take pretty pictures and I really fell in love with storytelling and documenting. So, you know, I want that for more students, more visual journalists. I want people to have access to visual journalism also, but I know I would, and even when I was in school, I wanted a higher value on the visual photojournalism programs. So I think, you know, there's always room to grow. You know, I think of Western Kentucky University and their amazing photo program. I want to see more of that just across the board. And like Sue said, I think all programming should just focus on visuals as a whole.
Sue did say that you are a really good photographer and you also help with social media. You have design skills and can write. Is doing it all what it takes these days to land a job in visual journalism? And how do you prepare yourself for being skilled at so many things?
So I'll preface this with saying I feel very fortunate to have the job that I have because it feels kind of like a unicorn job. Before this job kind of went where the jobs were, right? And you kind of have to do that in journalism. There's really no getting around that, but especially photo jobs. I have so many friends who are in different markets who want to, you know, expand their career and do so much more, but they feel stuck because there's no photo jobs or there's no, you know, visual jobs that they can like get to. I think having that well-rounded skill set definitely helps. And I think especially if nonprofit news is going to continue to be the wave that it is, you know, like Sue said, we all have to kind of work together and cover for each other. So I think it's crucial to have those skill sets. We all have our weaknesses, but having a basic understanding of how you can help support those efforts across social media, across, you know, designing Canva card stuff for social, I think it is important to have all of that. And the writing, I've never been in a job, even as a staff photographer, where I didn't write. You know, my first job, my title was staff photographer slash reporter. And then my second job was visual journalist and now multimedia producer and reporter. So I've never had just a photo job. My experience has been, yes, you have to know how to do all of that. It also just makes you more valuable. I've also had editors in the past who don't seem to value photo. And that's why photo is the first to be cut. You know, Sue kind of spoke to that already. So if you can write and do these other things, not that you should prove that you have value, but it helps, you know, show like, hey, I can do these other things too. And I always found a better sense of job security in that, just knowing I had that skill set to kind of bounce around.
I think there's a lack of understanding of just how much reporting a good photojournalist has to do as well. I mean, you're responsible for the information that goes on your photo, every single one that you take, you know, names, it's the who, what, when, where, why, plus the context of it. And I, you know, just know from my years out there that photojournalists on your staff often are the most well-rounded journalists you have on your staff. Because they have to be street smart. They have to be able to gauge a situation almost immediately when they drive up, you know, to a breaking news situation. They're your feet on the street often. They're your ambassadors out in the community because they're the ones everybody knows because they don't sit behind their desk all day. So I think that the idea of being a visual journalist, everyone needs to be a visual journalist because those are values every newsroom wants to have. And so I think some of the issue for me is people need to change how they think about photojournalism because it's good reporting. You know, it's not just we hand somebody a camera and they go push a button. It's good reporting and it's the most accessible reporting your newsroom will do. So I think there needs to maybe be a shift in how people think about it, especially in a digital environment that's incredibly visual and where you will not build audience if you don't have stories that resonate with them that are visually well supported so that they're accessible.
We are the face and the eyes of the community, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think 2020 was a great example of that, right? I mean, photojournalists were out covering COVID. We were at testing sites. I was working for the Hartford Courant at the time and, you know, had amazing colleagues, but they worked from home because of, you know, COVID safety. I was at the testing sites. I was providing them color for their stories. I was telling them what's going on. I was, you know, it's that deep reporting that you're doing visually. And kind of like Sue said earlier, you know, visual folks have a better sense of how to describe things. Words might not be our thing, but we can still describe things, you know, and help polish it up. But, you know, breaking news is another great one, like Sue mentioned. There were so many times where I would go out to photograph a breaking news site and the reporter would stay at the breaking news desk and I'd be, you know, getting quotes and sending that back.
Cassie, what do you think is your most valued skill or skill set? What do you really love doing every single day on the job? What is your week like at The Signal?
I think my most valuable skill set is, I don't know if it's self-centered to say, my empathy and like love of relationships with people, because I think that, well, I know that has carried me a long way in the way that I've been able to connect with my communities, and I love people. So I had been out of community news for, I don't know, about almost 2 years probably, and really missed, I had finally kind of recovered from my photo burnout, but I was also really missing the community and knowing who my neighbors were and knowing, you know, who was around me. So that's my favorite part of my day and my job, is like going out and meeting people and getting to know people. And, you know, obviously from there, the stories that are being told. As far as what my usual day looks like, I don't really have one.
Do you work like 40 hours a week? Do you work 5 days
at
a
least,
week? Or do you work like half days, seven
That's
days
the
a
goal.
Week? What's it like?
Yeah, the goal is 40 hours a week. It's usually a little extra, but again, small staff, we're still, you know, we're covering and we balance it all out. Typically Monday through Friday, unless we have weekend events, which, you know, we just had MLK weekend. So I worked Sunday. Sue helped cover for the actual holiday on Monday so I could take a day off. Yesterday I had, you know, just a relational meeting in the morning, and then I had like two assignments in the afternoon. Today, I don't have any actually assigned assignments. I'm writing a story that I've been reporting on this week. So it's really fluid, which I enjoy. I like having the mix of things. It helps me kind of just stay engaged in the work that I do. My previous job, I loved my colleagues, but I didn't love the like kind of Groundhog Day vibe that I had at the time. And so I really like kind of how mix and match my day is. And a lot of that lends itself also to the fact that I write and do all these other things as well. So
is there anything else either of you want to add that we haven't talked about yet?
We're part of Signal Ohio, which has two newsrooms already, is about, I think, to launch a third. So ultimately, our goal is to provide news and information to all of Ohio. The difficulty out in the media world for visual journalists to get jobs is kind of something I worry about. You know, even if a student's a great photojournalist, how many jobs are there? You know, there are entire startup publications that don't hire multimedia reporters and rely solely on handouts. So, you know, how healthy is that for the news universe at the end of the day? So for me, I'm just hopeful that as we move into nonprofit news, as that hopefully grows, keeps growing, it is growing right now, that, you know, visuals are a priority, you know, in addition to the other things you look for in your well-balanced newsroom, because I think it's a loss for the media universe if we don't have that, and if we don't strengthen it, because I think it's at probably the weakest point it's ever been in my lifetime and in my professional career.
Well, someday I hope there's a Signal Toledo. If so, Signal Ohio, hit me up. Be happy to help. Thank you, Sue Zake and Cassie Filkins, for joining me on ONPA's The Buckeye Visualist podcast to talk about Signal Akron and your vision for its future. As media publishers and owners continue their abandonment of hard copy newspapers and magazines and continue gutting newsrooms to make a profit, I'm relieved that online newsrooms like Signal Akron are filling that void. It's more important than ever that we adapt and support this change in how news is disseminated, because journalism matters, and we must fight for a robust, free press, and that includes truthful, ethical, visual coverage. So thank you, Sue and Cassie, for all you do for your little neck of the woods in Akron, Ohio. To support the Buckeye Visualist, please click on the Spotify link or RSS feed and stay tuned to our monthly shows. So you can find our episodes on the ONPA website's podcast page. Just go to onpa.org. I'm your host, Lori King, and thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Buckeye Visualist, brought to you by the Ohio News Photographers Association.
You've been listening to the Buckeye Visualist podcast.